I want to tell you a tale of two conferences. I had the privilege in 2010 to be part of the largest missions conference in history, the Lausanne Conference 3, held in Cape Town, October 2010. Now, I couldn't help but notice, being interested in history, that 2010 is exactly 100 years after 1910. And in 1910, the world's first missions conference had been held. Now, nobody at Cape Town 2010 mentioned this is the 100th anniversary of the first world missions conference in Edinburgh. But I couldn't help but think, but surely it can't be coincidence. Surely the planners must have planned it to be the centenary, but maybe they didn't even know. Maybe this is just God's sovereignty and an amazing coincidence. So Cape Town, in the shadow of Table Mountain, we held the largest missions conference ever held. 4,200 representatives from 198 countries in the world came together in Cape Town for a week to discuss world missions, world evangelization, and how we can be effective in winning our world to Christ and fulfilling the Great Commission. Now, William Carey, who founded the world's first missions society back in 1792 and launched the modern missionary movement in 1793, his sermon, Expect Great Things from God, Attempt Great Things for God, his book, An Inquiry into the Obligation of Christians, Whose Means for the Conversion of the Heathen, literally launched the modern missionary movement. And William Carey, on the way out to India, he stopped in Cape Town. And when he stopped in Cape Town, he looked and he said, we need to have a world missions conference. And he recommended that in 1810, there should be the first world missions conference held in Cape Town, at the junction between East and West, astride the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean, at the uttermost parts of Earth. Let us have a world missions conference in Cape Town, in the shadow of Table Mountain, in 1810. Now again, nobody mentioned this at the Lausanne 3 or Cape Town 2010 conference that I attended from any of the platforms. Even though I discussed that a lot amongst people in our cell groups and so on. But nobody mentioned that this is 200 years after William Carey recommended that we hold a World Missions Conference in Cape Town. And it's 100 years after the first World Missions Conference, which had been held in Edinburgh. So this is an amazing thing. William Carey was a man ahead of his time. He was 100 years ahead with recommending a World Missions Conference, and he's 200 years ahead of when it would be held in Cape Town. Is that not amazing? At the world's first missions conference, held in Edinburgh, Scotland, 1910, delegates were anticipating the completion of the Great Commission within their generation. The consensus of Edinburgh, 1910, was that every nation would be thoroughly evangelized and discipled, and all false religions would be extinct before 1960. Now that's when I was converted. I was converted in 1960. And I think you've noticed, we have not completed the Great Commission yet. Every nation is not discipled and evangelized yet. And Islam is not extinct yet, and neither is Buddhism and Hinduism. So what went wrong? Why is it that in 1910 they were anticipating the fulfillment of the Great Commission and the beginning of the millennium before the end of the 20th century? They honestly believed that they could be seeing the millennium begin before the end of the 20th century. And yet, when I attended the Cape Town 2010 Missions Conference, 4,200 delegates. There should have been 4,500, but the 300 delegates from Red China were not allowed to attend. China never allowed one of their people to attend, not the first Lausanne Congress, nor the second one in the Philippines, nor this one. There was a lot of worship. There was a lot of testimonies. It was a colorful event. It was fascinating. It was interesting. I was glad to be there. But I could not help but feel, knowing what I know about history, that we'd gone backwards. The church today is not as strong as the church was in 1910. Missions today is not as healthy as it was in 1910. Islam is stronger today than it was then. Do you know, we had at Lausanne 3, at Cape Town 2010, we were discussing human trafficking. Do you know that there's more slaves in the world today than there was when William Carey got it abolished? When William Wilberforce managed to get the slave trade abolished? We have more slaves in the world today than we had then. Human trafficking each year is bringing about 27 million people in slavery in the world today. Sex slavery, human trafficking, slavery in Muslim countries. 27 million slaves in the world today. 2015. This is outrageous. Widow burning is coming back to India. Horrible things. Acid being thrown in women's faces. The abuse. Honor murders. Thousands of Muslim women are murdered by their own family members for having a Western haircut or a Western boyfriend or being converted to Christianity. The things we were discussing at Cape Town 2010 were the sort of things that nobody in Edinburgh in 1910 would have believed could have ever happened again in the world. Because they had defeated those things. Even discussing how many children are dying of AIDS and other kinds of sexually transmitted diseases. We're in a shocking state of the world. Look at the world in 1900. The bright yellow represents where evangelicals are over 20%. The darkest red where they are less than 1%. That's 1900. And yet, where are we today? William Carey, Adnan Judson, David Livingstone, what would they have thought if they'd come into Cape Town 2010? Said, what is the matter with the church? You're discussing, does hell exist? Is the devil real? Is marriage only between a man and a woman? Where did we get to this point where we are not even sure what is right and wrong? They're again killing babies? There's churches that support abortion? What would Mary Slessor think when she had rescued twins from being killed at birth because they thought that the mother must be guilty of a great sin and one of these twins must be a demon? She was saving lives back over 100 years ago from this. And we're still battling this today? What would the missionaries who attended Edinburgh 1910 think about the outrageous compromises and backsliding of the churches today? What would Samuel Ajay Crowther say, that we've still got 27 million people in slavery today? Where has the church been? What have we been doing? What happened to derail the church from the greatest century of missions into the worst century of persecution? And there's one answer. World War I. 1914. The First World War was catastrophic. It derailed the greatest century of missions from fulfilling the Great Commission by getting Christians to kill one another in the millions and wasting the time, energy and resources of Christians into a complete, terrible, self-destructive, suicidal waste of time and money. And it prevented us fulfilling the Great Commission before 1960. Yes, there was a lot of courage in the First World War. There is no doubt. And I do not want to speak ill of the people who gave their lives fighting, they thought, for their countries. But the fact is that what they fought for was not freedom or democracy. Because no freedom and democracy followed their fighting, but in fact more tyranny and greater suffering. One of the great English authorities or historians on the First World War is A.J.P. Taylor. And I learned a lot from his history of the First World War and of the Second World War. And A.J.P. Taylor is a source of quite a lot of what I'm going to be saying now. The First World War saw 20th century weapons, but 19th century tactics. Trenches, aircraft, barbed wire, gas, grenades, flamethrowers. Hideous new weapons, tanks. On the 11th of November, all people in the English-speaking world remember those who died in the First and Second World Wars. And those of us who are moths, I'm a member of the memorial, the memorable order of the Tin Hat, those people who fought in combat, along with my father. I've got metal helmet, fought in combat. And we moths regularly remember those who have died at the going down the sun, and in the morning we will remember them. But what we need to remember even more is how the greatest century of missions was derailed into the worst century of persecution. The 19th century was the greatest century of Christian advance. It was a century of astounding inventions. More things were invented in the 19th century, the 1800s, in the 20th century. 20th century refined many of the inventions, but it's the 19th century that introduced many of these great steps. Typewriters, Geiger counters, cameras, megaphones, recording equipment, internal combustion engines, all of that was invented in the 19th century. Spectacular advances in technology. At the beginning of the 19th century, in the year 1801, nobody could travel faster than a horse could gallop. At the end, they were just about ready to fly. There were steam engines, steamboats, and getting ready for aerial technology. The largest man-made movable objects in the world, ships, like the Lusitania and the Titanic. Many countries in Europe experienced dramatic spiritual revivals, phenomenal spiritual revivals, under preaching of people like D.L. Moody and Spurgeon. Great revivals rocked the world in the 19th century. Even South Africa, an 1860 revival under Andrew Murray. Christian missionaries were winning whole tribes and nations to Christ in the remotest regions of the globe. Cannibals were coming to Christ. Missionaries like David Livingstone were setting captives free. Mary Slessor bringing the gospel into Nigeria, seeing that the Igbo people were freed from superstition and from slavery. Brave people adopting twins and abandoned infants. Courageous, bold missionaries. And Christian nations were just soaring in productivity, in technology, in freedom. But 1914 shattered Europe. An entire generation of young men died in brutal trench warfare. No other war changed the map of Europe so dramatically. At the end of the First World War, all these countries were created. New countries, like Yugoslavia, never existed before. For example, Czechoslovakia. Never had there been such a country. And Czechoslovakia doesn't exist today, and neither did it before the First World War. And neither did Yugoslavia. It doesn't exist now either, because it was a creation of the League of Nations, and what a mess. Other countries got their freedom that had lost it for years, like Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. Many territories changed hands between countries. The three great European empires of Germany, Austro-Hungary, and Russia were destroyed in the First World War. The great German Empire, which had been a bulwark of Europe, protecting Europe from the Eastern hordes, the Mongols and Huns and others through the centuries. The German Empire, which had produced the Great Reformation, which had produced most of the inventions of the 19th century, snuffed out. The House of Hohenzollern of the Kaiser, destroyed. A land of the greatest culture and some of the greatest musicians like Handel and Bach, destroyed. Germany had been the center and the heart of Europe, and still is economically in many ways, but they were shattered by the First World War. And not only Germany, who had Gott mit uns, God with us, on the belt buckles of all their soldiers, but the Russian Empire. The Russian Empire of the Tsar, which had civilized Northern Asia, which had defeated the Muslim hordes, which had spread Orthodox Christianity all the way to the Pacific Ocean and into the islands of the Pacific, which had defeated the Muslims in the whole of Central Asia. The Russian Empire was destroyed and replaced by the Communist Soviet Union. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, which had been the bulwark to protect Europe from radical Islam, from the Muslim Turks and the jihadists for centuries. Austria had been the Eastern Empire, the Österreich, the Eastern Empire that protected Europe. And now they too were cut to pieces by the Western powers and dismembered. At one point, the Ottoman Turks were all the way at the gates of Vienna. They seized Budapest. They put 200,000 Christians into chains as slaves and led them back to Turkey. Vienna twice endured sieges of the Muslims, 1526 and 1683, and had won on each time. 1914 marked the end of the greatest century of Christian advance and the beginning of what proved to be the worst century of persecution in history. More Christians have died in the 20th century of persecution than in all other centuries combined. The consequences of the First World War continues to have far-reaching repercussions to this present day. Of the 60 million European soldiers who were mobilized from 1914 to 1918 into the war, 9 million were killed. At least 9 million were killed. I've seen statistics going up to 12 and 14 million. It's possible. Records of especially the Russian Empire are not even in existence, so we don't have all the stats. But of those that we do have, we know at least 9 million were killed. Another 9 million were permanently disabled, crippled. So 9 million dead, another 9 million crippled. Another 15 million were seriously injured. That means more than half of all the soldiers mobilized were casualties. Contemporaries called the First World War the Great War because it was literally greater than any other war that had ever been waged in history. In terms of the numbers of soldiers involved, the greatest war. In terms of the number of casualties, the worst war. In terms of disastrous consequences, the most catastrophic event in the history of European civilization. In 1914, Christian nations ruled virtually the entire world. With the exception of China, Japan, and the Ottoman Empire, the globe was dominated by Christian powers. Either Protestant, as in the case of Britain and Germany and the United States, or Roman Catholic in the case of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the French Empire, the Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese, or Orthodox, as in the case of the Russian Empire. Following the Battle of Waterloo in 1815 and the conclusion of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, the Congress of Vienna ushered in a century of comparative peace, pretty much 99 years of peace. This was the agreed borders at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and this is how Europe remained basically until 1914. With the exception of southeastern Europe, where the Ottoman Empire was liberated through progressive Balkan wars. It was also a century of increased population growth, unprecedented increases in productivity, unprecedented standards of living. This being the world's first trade fair organized by Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert, and this is the Crystal Palace where Spurgeon even preached later. The 19th century had been a century of incredible achievements, incredible growth, incredible expansion. By 1914, all the inhabited world had been penetrated and, for the most part, the whole inhabited world had been mastered by people who traditionally were known as Christians. We're not saying they're all born-again evangelical believers, but they were at least nominally Christian and had some Christian ethos. And this is how the world was in 1910. Okay, China, Japan, and the Ottoman Empire are under the pagans, Muslims, Buddhists, the Shintus, but the rest of the world was Christian to one extent or another. Christians came to the beginning of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, on an apparently unstoppable tide, rising, advancing. Who could stop the growth of Christianity? Christianity was gaining spectacular momentum as missionaries from Europe were evangelizing and discipling virtually every tribe and nation. The Protestant faith had far outstripped the Catholic and Orthodox branches in missionary activity, in vitality, in initiative. From being confined almost exclusively to northwestern Europe and the British Isles, a narrow strip on the eastern seaboard of North America, and a very small outpost at the Cape of Good Hope, the Protestant faith in the 19th century became a truly international faith. It was also the dominant faith of the most productive, prosperous, powerful nations in both the northern and the southern hemispheres. Protestant nations were far and away high in literacy, productivity, industry, wealth, military power, in everything. The Protestants ruled the world. Dominated the world, for sure. So amidst irrepressible optimism, many were openly speaking of the beginning of the biblical millennium on earth. The church had grown spectacularly between 1815 and 1910. The first World Missions Conference in Edinburgh 1910, delegates were anticipating the completion of the Great Commission in their generation. In 1910, nobody would have anticipated the wholesale abandonment of entire countries to communism, to false religions like Islam, and to heathenism. That you'd have a revival of heathenism, even in England, where the Wiccans and the witch doctors are carrying on now at Stonehenge, which people had thought that was relics of an age-old past 2,000 years ago when the British were pagans. Now there are more pagans probably in Britain than Christians. Nor would anyone in 1910 have predicted that the church would retreat from victory to such an extent that some would even be questioning the existence of the devil or of hell, or reinterpreting marriage to include what God in the Bible describes as a perversion and an abomination. The Christian era of bold missionary advance came to an abrupt end as the guns of August 1914 erupted. The great Christian countries, the European countries that had been the heartland of Christendom, the source of most of the world's missionaries, devastated each other's economies and annihilated millions of one another's young men in what has to be recognized as the most senseless and tragic conflict in all of history. Before the First World War, Europe had never been more powerful. Never had there been a continent more self-confident. There was no hint of any possible challenge to their leadership of the civilized world, not militarily, not intellectually, not spiritually, not in any way. 1914 marks a far more drastic turning point than 1815, the Battle of Waterloo, or 1648, the end of the 30 Years' War and the Peace of Westphalia, or any other watershed event in earlier history. As the great nations of Europe mobilized for war against themselves, it was said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our own lifetime." Yet even as that was said, it could not have been anticipated how much destruction and dislocation of Christian civilization would come from the disastrous conflict. When lamps of political wisdom and spiritual truth, or intellectual or artistic progress, or moral foundations and economic growth were rekindled, they shone far less brightly in the ancient centers of European civilization than they had for centuries before. Things are pretty dark in Europe at this moment. Ronald Reagan's chief advisor, Patrick Buchanan, who wrote many of the speeches, has written the book Churchill, Hitler and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost the Empire and the West Lost the World. I've read this book several times in the last year. I think it's the best history book on the First and Second World War that I've come across so far. Patrick Buchanan's done us a phenomenal job in putting this together. And he basically says, by Britain getting involved in the First and Second World War, they lost their own empire and they destroyed Western civilization. And the man that Patrick Buchanan blames for this is Winston Churchill. Many British people call him the greatest Englishman of the 20th century. Some call him the greatest Englishman of all the centuries. I would call him the worst Prime Minister Britain has ever had in terms of the damage he did. When he became First Lord of the Admiralty in 1910, Britain was the greatest power the world had ever seen. By the time he finished his Prime Ministership, Britain was finished, destroyed as a world power. And he, more than anyone, made that possible by allying Britain with its traditional enemies against its traditional allies, against its own best interests. And the sinister banksters, the bankers who are gangsters, the banksters we call them, who pulled the strings behind the scenes and engineered the auto-genocide of Europe, were the same ones who owned many of the companies that made the machine guns, the bullets, the bombs, the artillery shells, the gas, and all the different munitions of wars, the shells, the artillery that destroyed the cream of Europe. The Rothschilds, in particular, were the ones who supplied all the artillery to both sides of the war and got those nations in bankruptcy in owning everything and mortgaging their entire nations to these banksters. The artillery that the Russians used, the artillery that the French used, the artillery that the Germans used, the tanks that the British made, all were made by the same people, the Rothschilds. Here you can see the building up of armaments before the Great War. In the circle you see the peacetime budgets converted to 1914 dollars in millions. You can see Britain is spending more money on the army and navy than Germany is. You can see that Russia is spending far more than both of them are. You can see the size of the British army is not as big as the others because they're depending more on the navy. Germany's got a strong army, but France has got as strong and is spending the same amount of money, even though France was much smaller, half the size of Germany in population. Russia has got an army almost twice as much as that of Germany. And you see how the budgets balance. There are numerous studies that have shown the role of Freemason bankers and politicians like Lord Nathan Rothschild, whose goal was to bring down Christian civilization. Lord Nathan Rothschild was on the British war cabinet, and he was also the owner of most of the factories that produced these weapons, and he was in charge of the Bank of England. So he declared war and got the government to borrow money from him to pay him for the weapons that he supplied to kill Christians. A Jewish banker who is one of the synagogue of Satan. Nathan Rothschild had once said, "I care not what puppet is placed upon the throne of England to rule the empire on which the sun never sets. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire. And I control the British money supply." War is the greatest debt creator known to man. And these synagogue of Satan banksters, these Freemason, Antichrist pagans, Morgan, Rothschild and Rockefeller, they became multi-billionaires out of the First World War. This is the symbol of the Freemasons, a secret anti-Christian organization built on atheistic principles. They're occultic, actually. And you can see a lot of their symbols. They call this the Star of David. That's not the Star of David. David wouldn't know nothing about it. This symbol is from Babylon. It's an occultic symbol. It's something used by all the Satanists in their worship. And you can see the reptilian eye of Osiris or Nimrod, the cult of three-horned god, even in the American dollar bills. This is a symbol of the Rothschilds, which includes the beast and a whole lot of other kinds of biblical imagery. Nathan Rothschild. Here you can see Joseph Rothschild and his children. They controlled all the banks of Europe. This Jewish Freemasonry family, this is Meyer Rothschild, who took over from him running the Bank of England. Here you can see they managed to have their sons control the Bank of England, Germany, Austria, Italy, France, another one later, the bank in America too. They managed to get themselves, even by buying it, titles like Lord Nathan Rothschild. Although they were not Christians, you should not have had Jews be able to be a lord in England, but they had the money so they could buy these things. Going right down to the Rothschilds today. This is the richest family in the world. They control almost all the banks. They control Hollywood. They control the news media. And so you understand that what you get in the media is anti-Christian, because the people running it are anti-Christian. This is the top Rothschild today. False flags. You have a horrific staged event blamed on a political enemy and used as a pretext or an excuse to start a war or to enact draconian laws in the name of national security. False flags. Nothing could have stopped the positive onward march of Christianity worldwide except that Christians were persuaded to kill one another so efficiently and so enthusiastically. During the course of the Great War, 8% of Great Britain's total population were killed or wounded. 9% of Germany's total population were killed or wounded. 11% of France's total population were killed or wounded. But even more devastating than the actual numbers of people killed, crippled or injured, was the physical damage and the spiritual damage done to the life of Europe. Europe went from being a majority church-attending population to a continent where most people didn't go to any church at all. The secularization of Europe and the breakdown of moral standards coincide with a great resurgence of revolutionary fervor. Marxist communism filled the vacuum left by the collapse of the Russian Empire and the emergence of many new countries in Eastern Europe in place of the Austrian Empire. And along with the spiritual decline of Europe came the decline of Western civilization in the total world scene, and a revival of paganism and Islam. The 19th century had seen such staggering growth in numbers, productivity, military power and wealth that one would have expected that Europe would have continued to dominate the globe for centuries to come. And it would have, except for the fact that they got conned into killing one another in such phenomenal numbers. For over 1,000 years, Europe had been Christendom, the heartland of, and the stronghold of Christian civilization, the land of the Reformation. So the productivity of Europe was shattered by the First World War. The optimism which had prevailed in the 19th century gave way to profound pessimism after the First World War. The de-Christianization and the secularization of Europe was unprecedented in its scope and speed. Without the First and Second World War, it would have been unthinkable. Unthinkable that Europe could have become endangered of becoming Eurabia. In Europe, the traditional stronghold of the Christian faith, the proportion of those people who called themselves Christians declined, and the percentage of those actually attending church fell off even more drastically. Before the First World War, 64% of Europe was in church every Sunday. After the Second World War, not even 4% were in church every Sunday. Went from 64% to 4% in 30 years. While Protestants increased rapidly in Africa, North and South America and Asia, the numbers of Christians in Europe has declined drastically. So what could have caused such a cataclysm? It should be noted to you that social Darwinism, evolutionism, had become popular amongst most of the governments of Europe. This thinking emphasized the importance of armed struggle between nations as healthy, necessary for evolution and progress. Because how did life evolve? By destruction and death. Big bang, explosion. So if we could just have more explosions and more death, everything will get better, right? Well, according to evolution, yes. Darwin's thinking had infected the rulers of Europe. His Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection and the Preservation of Favored Nations in the Struggle for Life. Survival of the Fittest. And so evolution led to the First World War. There were also entangling alliances between Britain and France and Russia, which Britain had always been the enemy of France and Russia. Britain had always been the ally of Germany. Always. Never in history had Germany and Britain fought one another, because the British and the Germans are the same people. Anglo-Saxons. Here you can see, this is Operation Wolves map, showing the German, Scandinavian and British people are the same basic tribe. They're Germanic people, Germanic language. The Anglo-Celtic, Germanic and Scandinavian are the same people. And yet, and they'd always been together. And now for the first time, they're fighting against one another. Protestants fighting against one another on the side, in the case of Britain, of Catholic and Humanist France and Orthodox Russia. The question is, why would Britain have formed an alliance with their traditional enemies against their traditional allies? And how did a terrorist act in Sarajevo sever the special relationship between Britain and Germany that had endured for centuries? And that's something we must go into tomorrow.